Good morning. We're going to go ahead and get on the record and get the hearing started. I'll let the record show that it is 9 a.m. on September 15th, 2014. We are present at Teddy's Residential Suites in Watford City, North Dakota, for the public hearing in the matter of the application of One Oak Bakken Pipeline LLC for a certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit for the Targa Lateral Pipeline Project in McKenzie County, North Dakota. This is case number PU-14-254. My name is Wade Mann, and I'm the procedural administrative law judge designated to preside in this matter. At this time, I will take appearances for the record, beginning with the applicant.
Mr. Examiner John Morrison, PO Box 2798, Bismarck, North Dakota, appearing for One Oak Bakken Pipeline, LLC.
Okay. And commission advisory staff?
Brian Schmidt, appointed Special Assistant Attorney General, and next to me is Victor Shook, Public Utility Analyst for the Public Service Commission.
Okay. And also present today are members of the Public Service Commission, Chairman Brian Kalk, Commissioner Randy Christman, and Commissioner Julie Fedorchek. I will be calling on the commissioners shortly for opening remarks after providing a brief summary of the issues to be before the commission today and addressing the procedure for the hearing. The issues that are to be addressed at today's hearing, as set forth in the notice of hearing, with respect to the application for waiver of procedures and time schedules, there are two issues. Number one, are the proposed facilities of such length, design, location, or purpose that they will produce minimal adverse effects and that adherence to applicable procedures and time schedules may be waived? And number two, is it appropriate for the commission to waive any procedures and time schedules as requested in the application? And with respect to the application itself, for the certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit, there are three issues. Number one, will the location, construction, and operation of the proposed facilities produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and upon the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota? Number two, are the proposed facilities compatible with the environmental preservation and the efficient use of resources? And number three, will the proposed facility locations minimize adverse human and environmental impact while ensuring continuing system reliability and integrity and ensuring that energy needs are met and fulfilled in an orderly and timely fashion? With respect to the procedure for the hearing, before we get started with the evidentiary portion and the remarks from the commissioners, will just briefly address that. One Oak will make its presentation first, calling its witnesses and presenting any documentary evidence that it wishes to have into the record. Once One Oak has finished questioning each witness, commission advisory staff may then question the witnesses, followed by questions from the commissioners. And once the commissioners have completed their questioning, I will allow any follow-up questioning as necessary. And upon completion of One Oak's presentation of its case, any public witnesses that wish to offer testimony will be given an opportunity. The public witnesses will come up to the table, be sworn, and offer testimony to the commissioners. Any public witnesses testifying will also be subject to questioning from counsel for One Oak, advisory staff, and the commissioners. I will be serving as the procedural administrative law judge in this case, and that means that the commissioners are the ones who will be making the final determination with respect to whether or not to approve the application of One Oak for the certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit. No decision will be reached on the matter today. These proceedings are being recorded and will be available for later review. Are there any questions concerning the procedures to be followed? Any other preliminary matters to discuss before getting into comments from the commissioners or the evidentiary portion of the hearing?
Your Honor, we request that Mr. Shook be allowed to ask questions today.
Okay. Any objection, Mr. Morrison? Okay. Mr. Shook, you'll be allowed to question witnesses as well. At this time, then, I will call on the commissioners for any opening remarks, beginning with Commissioner Fedorchek.
Good morning, everyone. Glad to see you here today. Could I first just ask if there's any members of the public here who intend to have anything to say? I didn't have a chance to run around and introduce myself before, so I usually try to identify those folks so everyone here is representing the company or just interested in general. Okay, well, just to provide just a few brief opening comments, I think the application for us is very thorough. The company did a good job covering all the bases there. Staff also, Victor, this is your first pipeline project, and I think you did a good job of asking some follow-up questions and getting additional information even prior to the hearing, so that's helpful in reviewing this as well. As from my perspective, this is my first NGL pipeline, so I'm going to use it as a learning opportunity to better understand if there's any technical differences between NGL pipelines and other pipelines and just kind of grow my knowledge base there. But in terms of specific questions, I will focus on the reclamation, how the company's commitment to the reclamation, how you're going to work with individual landowners to make sure they're satisfied with the reclamation, both immediately and the long term. Obviously, we're always interested in your safety plans, your operations, leak prevention, and all those sorts of issues. And so those would be kind of the big areas that I'll focus on in terms of my questions. But in general, I noted on the way down here this morning in the newspapers yesterday, a big story about how the flaring has been reduced in North Dakota from 36% a year ago to 26% today. That's a significant improvement, something we can all cheer and applaud and look for more of. And this kind of project helps deliver those kind of improvements, and so we recognize that. I recognize that, and want to be supportive of this kind of infrastructure development. So, with that, I'll turn it over to the rest of my colleagues, and look forward to a good hearing. Thank you,
Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Julie, for your comments. The Monday morning, we're at 1-1 today. The Bison won, but the Vikings didn't, so we won't call that a success weekend. But anyway, it's always good to be out in northwestern North Dakota. Julie laid it out perfectly with the application. I thought it was very thorough. I don't really have a lot of probing questions other than the standard emergency response questions, and maybe just a little bit about the change from 6-inch to 8-inch. Maybe it does need to be 12-inch pipeline. It seems like every one of these pipelines, we give ourselves some flexibility to even give ourselves more capacity. If there's something we could do on that, I think that might be worthwhile, because it just seems like these numbers keep growing. And just like we do in wind farms, sometimes we give a range of things. Maybe it's time we start looking at for pipelines, giving a range of diameters, that as long as the criteria is the same, that we'll give some flexibility as we get into the construction season. So other than that, I don't have anything except the last comment. There are no members of the public here right now, but for the record, we'll make sure we ask anyone that wants to testify today. The biggest reason we're out here is because we always want to be in the community most affected to develop a full thorough record, get any concerns early that there might be out there. And so the judge will be asking for that again at the close of the hearing. So just thank you all for coming.
Commissioner Chrisman.
To elaborate on Julie's point about the improvements that the industry has made, going from 36% of the gas flared a year ago to 26% now, I thought the other part of that was that it's 26% of a much larger number too. So the improvement has been really dramatic in a year. I see no hands went up when Julie asked about members of the public that want to testify, but maybe someone will change their mind. So if you would happen to change your mind, I'm talking to you right now. One of the things that we do that I used to feel frustrated with as a member of the public when I went to meetings on this order was the fact that you come at the starting time and then you sit there for hours while the company of people who are getting paid to do this gets to go first, and you have to sit and wait on your own time. But the reason that we do that is so that you're not responding to something that's not accurate, that you heard uptown or that's a perception. So we allow the company to go first, really lay out what it is that is the actual project, and then have the public respond to that. And if throughout the course of the day you are inclined to comment, it's important to us. We could have this meeting in Bismarck and do it more simply, but we come out here because we want to hear from the people who are out here directly impacted. That's how we can do our job the best and make our best decisions, is by having all the information. So that's why we're here. So I guess if anyone has thoughts on it, even if you're not sure exactly of how your opinions fit into the overall equation, we encourage you to speak up at the end. That's why we're out here, to gather as much information as possible.
Thank you. Do you have an opening statement, Mr. Morrison?
Very briefly, this matter involves a request by One Oak to construct a pipeline to transport natural gas liquids, or what are called NGLs, from Targa Resources' Little Missouri plant to One Oak's Garden Creek pipeline. The commission might remember several years ago, One Oak cited a pipeline that went from the Garden Creek plant to Riverview, Montana, for the purpose of transporting NGLs, and it's that pipeline that will be used to further transport these NGLs. The original application, as I think Commissioner Kalk indicated, was for a 10.6-mile, 6-inch pipeline. In August, we filed an amendment that increased the diameter to 8 inches for possible future needs, and also involved two minor reroutes to accommodate some issues on the land. We're going to have three witnesses testify today. James Akinbola is the project manager and is going to describe the project and the anticipated time frame for construction. Jeff Newman is going to discuss some of the emergency response, community preparedness kinds of issues. And Bill McCarthy will discuss basically the studies and the environmental and cultural resource issues that were investigated. We do have two exhibits, and we anticipate those will be the only exhibits. They are the application dated May 2014 and the amendment dated July 2014. I guess I would move the admission of those exhibits at this time. That way, it's easier for the witnesses to use them in their testimony.
Any objection, Mr. Schmidt?
No objection.
Okay, exhibits 1 and 2 are received and entered into the record.
I would also note for the record that we did file a couple of documents late last weekend, and depending upon when people last checked the docket, they might not have them. I do have copies of those here if anybody has questions or if we need to look at them. The certification, which is requested by the commission staff, was filed last Thursday as docket entry 18. And then on Friday, we filed the SHPO concurrence, and that is docket entry number 19. And again, if there are any questions or if we need to look at those, I have copies, plenty of copies to go around. But I don't intend to offer them as exhibits since they are already filed in the Public Service Commission's docket. And with that, we would call our first witness, James Akinbola.
Mr. Akinbola, prior to your testimony, I'm required to give you an oath, and in doing so, I'm required to advise you that the penalty for perjury in North Dakota is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
Yes, I do.
Okay, go ahead.
James, would you state your name and also spell your last name for the record?
My name is James Akinbola. Last name, A-K-I-N-G-B-O-L-A.
And can you tell us by whom you're employed and what capacity?
I'm employed by One Oak Partners. I'm a project manager on the large constructions project group up in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
And can you just describe for the commission your professional background, perhaps your college education, and what your field of expertise is?
I'm a chemical engineer by, study. I went to the University of Oklahoma. Right out of college, I got a job with One Oak on the distribution side. So I was a pipeline engineer for the first 3 years. Following that, I took on another position on the integrity management side of pipeline. So I did that for a year and a few months before joining the large construction group with One Oak Partners. So I've been with the group for a year and 4 months now, building new pipelines.
And you're familiar with the pipeline we're discussing today, which is known as the Targa Lateral Pipeline?
Yes, sir.
Can you just describe the purpose of that line for the commission, please?
The pipeline, as we discussed earlier on, would be a natural gas liquids pipeline transporting liquids from the Targa Little Missouri plant facility to the existing One Oak Garden Creek pipeline. It's a 10-inch that goes on from the Garden Creek plant onto the Riverview terminal. I don't know if you're aware of this. We recently, last year, completed construction on the Bakken pipeline, which transports Y-grade NGL, just like this one from Montana to just north of Colorado. It's about a 500-mile pipeline. So this, along with other future projects, will be bringing in products to the Bakken pipeline and taking it down to MidCon and to the Texas area where the NGLs will be used.
And without this pipeline in place, what are the alternatives that you're aware of that Targa has for handling those natural gas liquids? Are they trucked?
Yeah, right now they're being trucked to another one facility, the Grasslands plant. It's just about the 20-30 miles from Sydney. And we currently do close to 8 trucks a day, about 1,600 barrels per day. And they also have capabilities shipping them via rail. They have about 2,400 barrels per day capability on the rail side that moves it to the MidCon area. So there are 4,000 barrels a day that could be moved now.
And can you describe for the commission the pipeline that you're proposing to construct, the length and diameter and some of the specifics of the line?
We're proposing to construct an 8-inch pipeline that would serve not only the purposes of Targa for the current capacity they have. We're anticipating them ramping up to close to 10,000 barrels per day by the end of the year or early next year. And this pipeline will be able to do that. Talking about the upsize, we originally planned for 6, and the 6-inch would, in fact, do more than the 10,000 barrels a day for Target's purposes, but we did rethink the market initiatives to reduce flaring, which we're proud to be a part of, to reduce that impact here. So we decided to come up with a larger pipeline to handle future growth in the areas, none that I can speak about today or that I know today, but you did ask if a 12-inch would really be what we need. It looks like we think an 8-inch would serve our purposes here.
So you've got some excess capacity built into the 8-inch?
Yes, there's more than enough for now.
And is it steel pipeline?
It's a steel pipeline, DOT regulated pipeline, meets the DOT 195 and would be considered a transmission pipeline.
And will there be surface facilities constructed in addition to the pipeline?
There'll be two, one at the kickoff end there at the Targa plant that would have a launcher, a pig launcher for pipeline integrity and assessment. And there'll be a meter there as well to offer measurement. And it's going to be tied to our SCADA system to control valves. And at the tying end to the Warner Garden Creek pipeline would have another pig receiver to receive the pigs following those inline inspections. And those are the only two above-ground facilities we have right now.
And so that will be there. There won't be any above-ground facilities between the plant and the tie-in?
No.
Is handling the liquids, the natural gas liquids, is that essential to the continued operation of the Little Missouri plant?
Yes.
And that is necessary to reduce flaring?
It is necessary. It allows them bring in the gas to process, which we take the liquids following the processing of the gas.
And James, you're aware that in August we filed an amendment that slightly revised the routes. Is that correct?
Yes, we did.
Can you maybe describe the reasons for those route revisions?
Well, we had two route revisions, one around, excuse me, I refer to most of them by milepost. It's easy that way. It's around the Jack Edstrom property. We had long surveyed and planned and pinned the route down without the landowner letting us know that he had other plans at that location. Anyways, there's a well pad there. Looks like it belongs to Hess. That was considerably very close to the pipeline, if not on the pipeline. So we did have to go back to reroute away from that construction activity and locate us where we feel comfortable to not have any other impacts. It's all attributed to the amount of work going on in this county. The second reroute was at the Targa plant, where we initially proposed our kickoff was a couple hundred feet away from where they would be locating their tying pipe to One Oak, so we had to make that adjustment too. But all in all, there are not major reroutes that we made.
And it's correct that that slightly increased the length of the pipeline, is that correct?
Yes, slightly, from a 10.6 to a 10.8-mile pipeline.
Can you describe for the commission what your schedule is for construction on the pipeline?
Our plan is to begin construction end of September, very early October, and this allows us to finish construction just before Thanksgiving with all, you know, with all things working well, weather impacts and all. We're anticipating about 6 to 7 weeks for construction and cleanup efforts. The longer we push it into those would bring us close to a December time frame.
So in other words, we're asking for an order just as soon as possible, is that correct?
Yes.
And does One Oak have all of the right-of-way necessary to construct the line?
In hand, we have all but one received. The other, we're recently told, has been mailed out to One Oak. We like to believe we do, but we generally don't say we have all the right-of-way, but until we have the paper in hand, executed documents in hand.
But in that one, you have the email from the landowner.
We have the email from the landowner stating that we're executed and good to go.
And can you describe the estimated cost of the line?
The estimated cost is about a $6 million project overall. And that's on the 6-inch side of the pipeline.
And have you finalized the additional costs that might be incurred as a result of the 8-inch line?
No, we're still working on that. As you know, there are other factors that would rise and that would cause a rise in price following the rise in, increase in size of the pipeline construction as well. We recently went out for construction bids and we're evaluating the bids now, and very shortly we anticipate issuing an updated project cost. We don't anticipate it growing very large, but it's going to be some slightly significant increase to the cost of the pipeline.
And I don't have any further questions of this witness this time.
Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Your Honor. The amended route application, you're basically changing from a 6-inch pipeline to an 8-inch pipeline. Can you just kind of describe how much of a capacity change that allows for?
Without having my calculations with me here, I know we can do, with a 6-inch, we can do more than 10,000 barrels per day on that pipeline. I don't want to bring out a specific number here, but I know we can much more surpass that 10,000 on the 8-inch. It's going to be more than a 25%. Around a 25% increase in capacity compared to the 6-inch, which the 6-inch can handle more than 10,000 barrels a day.
You testified earlier about the above-ground facilities that will be constructed as a result of this pipeline. You said it was going to be a pig launcher and I believe it's a meter skid.
Yes, sir.
Can you just describe what a meter skid is?
And excuse me for that. The meter just allows us to have an official custody transfer between the two companies. So it's a way to verify how much exactly we're getting from them for billable services and things like that. It allows us to verify with Target that we received X amount of NGL for this period, and they can in turn bill One Oak for it, or One Oak can bill them for it.
What does it look like? I guess can you just kind of give
a it's going to be, it's going to be, I believe on this size, it's a 4-inch piping. It's got two different meters. It's going to be about a 15 or 20 by 5 rectangular meter skid, and it's going to be above ground sitting on supports, on pier supports.
How deep will this pipeline be laid?
How
deep will it be under the surface?
It's per DOT rules, we're 4 feet, at least 4 feet.
If I can have you turn to appendix, did you have a copy of the amended application?
Oh, no, I don't. Right. Appendix B,
and then there's four maps there that are just just labeled Targa Lateral Pipeline Project Siting Criteria, Natural Resource Aerial Map.
Okay.
Looking at map, page 104. It's just starting at the Targa Little Missouri plant and working our way from right to left on here. I notice there's a variety of water crossings.
Yes.
Can you just kind of briefly describe how you handled each of these water crossings that are on this map?
And I think I would have Bill talk about them later on, but typically per our nationwide 12 permit, we, depending on what's in it at this time, we have the option of open cutting or just boring under the waterway. If it's one of those that it's too full, we can't sustain or pump out the water as we're constructing, we have that option to bore the pipeline and not impact it greatly, but we're within our permits to either open cut on these or decide during construction to bore them to not have any impact on the wetlands.
Do you anticipate boring during construction?
We have some of these planned to be bored, just depending on the time of the year and what's going on. So we do have that figured into our plans.
Which ones do you plan on boring?
Anyone's here. It's going to be a constructability decision out there on the field, depending on the, what's flowing, if it's something we can pump out. There are a few of them large enough that we know will be boring. I don't know if it's on this page. Try to see here. And I apologize that I don't have my alignment sheets. My alignment sheets has the construction plans that allows me to refer to which ones that for sure designated bores.
Well, in the application, it talked about Cherry Creek being a classified fishery. Would that be the type of water body that you would anticipate boring?
Yes, if it's stated that way in the permit, we will.
Can you just kind of walk us through the boring process for an NGL pipeline?
It's the same as the rest of the pipelines. We pretty much string the pipeline together, and I say string, which means we lay the pipeline side by side. We set them up on skids, weld them all up together, and then we get a boring rig out there to ream the hole, to bore the hole, to pull it back to make sure it's stable, and then we pull the pipeline from the other side towards the boring rig. And that we weld a cap to the pipeline that has a sort of handle for the boring rig to pull through, and we pulled the pipe through that way.
You did mention earlier that the way you'd construct this would kind of depend on the time of year, especially with regard to the boring waterways and stuff like that. Do you have any type of contingency plan in case the ground freezes in the construction of this project?
Yes, we do. And again, typically in this area, we don't see those ground freeze-off conditions until a little bit after Thanksgiving, where the frost depth gets to about 6 feet. But if we're delayed in construction that way, we'll be treating everything as though it's rock. It's all going to be, we would strip off the topsoil, try to push it off to another side to conserve it, and then strip off the subsoil. It's all going to be broken as though it's rock, because it's really frozen when we're constructing in the wintertime. Sometimes you bring out chunks of boulders, dirt that are just clumped up together. So, and before we put the dirt back in there, we crush it all like it's rock again, for the sake of our pipeline and for the sake of minimizing subsidence issues for reclamation purposes. So we crush all that back up together and compact it before we put this topsoil back on.
In the amended route, you testified that there's a reroute around a well pad, and just they moved the tie-in place to where they were gonna tie into the Little Missouri plant.
Yes.
Why was it necessary to reroute around the well pad?
Just integrity purposes for the pipeline, where you have a lot of traffic crossing the pipeline, and it was planned for an open cut type of crossing on that now access road to the well side, to the well pad side. And it also looked like the plans that we received from the company showed some of their tanks, if not all of their tanks, sitting above the pipeline. Per DOT rules, we need to have access to our pipeline at any given time. So that would impact our operation and the maintenance of the pipeline if we didn't reroute it. It was just what we needed to do.
Are you going to be the one who testifies about landowner relations and waivers and that type of thing, or should I table that for another witness?
Yeah, I think we'll table that okay. for the witness.
In the application, it just states that block valves along the pipeline are located at regular intervals. Can you just kind of describe what a regular interval for a block valve with this type of pipeline would be?
Per DOT rules, we, you know, you have a block valve. Pretty much it's an isolation method to isolate certain parts of the pipeline. You can have them before or immediately after major water crossings, which we don't have in this case. There are some rules requiring spacing, valve spacing, as far as, you know, miles between the pipeline around that. It could be 10 miles, it could not be, but it also it's just mainly serving as isolation purposes for the pipeline. In this case, we don't have any that would fall under that or be classified that would need an isolation on the pipeline. So we think we're comfortable with the two isolation valves on the launcher as those valves.
The application talks just briefly about the labor market that you're going to be using to construct this pipeline. I just have one or two questions. Is that down here?
Sorry, I didn't. Can you repeat that?
Sorry about that. The application talks about very briefly about the labor market that will be used to okay. build this. Is that, are you in charge of the labor for this?
Yes, we've. Okay.
It states that it's a niche construction market and the labor force will be comprised of non-local workers. Can you just explain what makes this particular type of construction it makes it necessary to have non-local workers work on this?
Well, we don't control what labor forces or markets the contractor goes out to employ from. It's our preference to have someone close to the area because it helps with the mob cost and demob cost. So again, we just received bids in, so I'm not able to say for a fact that I know where the labor will be coming in from. We did bid the job out to contractors in this county, outside the state, in the state, and we're trying to get a full mix to see who's going to be the most competitive bidder that would get us in and out in our desired schedule.
Can you estimate how many workers it's going to take to construct this project?
I'm anticipating that full ramp up on the 10-mile pipeline, we may see close to 120.
Is there any type of housing situation lined up for these workers?
We don't, as from ONEOK standpoint, we don't get ourselves involved in that. The contractor typically does that for his guys, and it's all part of their contract cost.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Shook, you have any questions at this time?
No.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Thank you, James.
You're welcome.
Can you explain for me any sort of constructional or operational differences between an NGL pipeline versus just a natural gas?
Well, starting with the DOT rules, the natural gas pipelines fall under the DOT 192, mm-hmm. And the natural gas liquids falls under 195. For the most part, they're set out to do the same things, make sure that operators know what they're putting in the ground, and they can verify and trace what's been below the ground. It's regulated the same way. They're both transmission pipelines. As far as the properties in the pipeline, just like your gasoline, you run your cars on natural gas liquids under pressure are a liquid in the pipeline, but once they hit that atmospheric pressure, they flash off and turn to vapor. Natural gas is also lighter, much lighter than natural gas liquids. What we call natural gas liquids is just a mix of all the other heavy hydrocarbons. So it's taken it from a plant. Once they get the dirty gas in from the wellheads, the first thing we process for is natural gas. It's the lightest. You heat it up and it goes in gas form. The rest of that is not processed, drops down. That's what we call the heavy hydrocarbons, and that's what we call the NGL, natural gas liquids. It's just the unprocessed parts of the dirty gas after you've taken the natural gas out.
Is the pipe thicker? Is the pressure higher? What about those kinds of differences?
The same pipe can carry natural gas liquids and carry the same natural gas pipeline. The pipe stays the same there. You can run them with the same pressure. The only thing about it is you can compress gas and move more in one where you can't compress liquid. So where you have natural gas and you need to have a sort of compression to move more down the pipeline, which you really can't compress liquids, you have pump stations for. So you pump liquids and you compress mm-hmm. gas to move a lot more at one time.
So will your pumping stations be undercover?
We don't have, on this pipeline, we don't have any pump stations. The very first pump station will not be until we get to the Riverview terminal on the Bakken pipeline, because they're collecting all the Garden Creek, the little Targa lateral stuff, and pumping everything and sending them down the pipeline. So on this, we don't anticipate any pump stations.
So where does the pressure come to move the product?
The pressure would come from the Targa plant.
Okay. Okay, someplace in the application, I read about the expansion at that plant, at the Little Missouri plant.
Yes.
Can you describe that and how that's changing the volumes of NGLs being produced there?
Well, right now they're doing close to 4,000 barrels per day. They anticipate ramping that up to a number around 10,000 barrels a day, which is what we're planning for. So right now they're doing four, and when they're done with the expansion work at the plant, their capabilities will move up to 10,000 barrels a day.
And what's the natural gas processing at the plant? How does that change?
I can't speak specifically towards that. I just know that it allows them to bring a lot more natural gas. So they're processing a lot more natural gas for us to have a lot more natural gas liquids is the way I can put it.
Okay. You don't know the change in the capacity at that plant?
For the natural gas, no, I don't.
Okay. What's the time frame on that expansion?
What is being communicated to us would be towards the end of the year.
Okay. I think you mentioned earlier how many of the easements have been obtained, but I missed it. Can you restate that for me, please?
We have all but one.
Okay.
Technically, we do, but until we have that document in our hands, we don't consider it as closed on. We did get an email from the landowner on Saturday stating that they've signed and the executed easement was in the mail. So we anticipate getting it today, tomorrow.
Okay. Can you, or maybe a later witness will be talking about the key safety features of this line? Can you summarize those, or is that better left for somebody else?
I think it would be better off when we get to the emergency response.
Okay.
If there are any specifics to that, I think you can answer it.
Okay.
But I can touch on the SCADA aspect as far as the monitoring, the remote monitoring aspect of the pipeline would have that capability here. At the Targa plant, along with the meter skid, would have a meter control building in there. It's about an 8x8 type building that houses the flow computers that ties into our Tulsa monitoring support over there. And they're able to see what's coming in the line, what's flowing out of the line, and they're able to remotely isolate the pipeline, meaning shut the valve at the Targa facility.
Mm-hmm. And those will be monitored from Tulsa?
Yes.
Okay, then I think my last question revolves around the reclamation. Is there a difference in reclamation challenges in the winter versus, summer, fall, spring construction?
Oh, yes, there is. Depending on how frozen the ground is, You're not able to get the compaction you need. It's sometimes you get the false compaction because it's all ice and dirt, which when the spring thaw occurs, everything just turns into water, goes down, and then you have the natural just subsidence go on, which doesn't bring you back to the original level. What we're doing here to mitigate against that is, you know, first off, let's have the subsoil segregated from the topsoil and crush the dirt, have some compaction. Some that have been using 6-inch lifts on a compaction before they put it in the ground and laying the topsoil on it to make sure you have full compaction. Some right of way, they emphasize it a little bit and leave some sort of crown on top of the right of way. So if that spring thaw does occur and the ground wants to get back to its native state, you have that additional 1 or 2 inches just naturally redistribute and you get back to your original grade.
Mm-hmm. What kind of follow-up work does your company do in that scenario where you're reclaiming in the winter and you know there might be some challenges in the spring?
Well, there's sweep stormwater pollution plan monitoring going on that, you know, we inspect and make sure we have right of way back to what it was pre-construction, and we have inspection going on, and they take notes and report back to the project team, letting us know that we may need to come back and fix the issue. And generally, we have the mainline contractor aware of this to where they come back and recompact and throw additional seeds back up there to leave us to the pre-construction conditions.
So what's what's your company's commitment to reclamation with your easement holders?
We want to leave them their land in the state of, you know, pre-pipeline construction. Again, per the permits we have out there, the sweep plans, we're obligated to do that and bring it back to original grade. Again, with the construction going on in town here, we know there may be a chance that we'll be back for another project. So it's good to leave the landowner in good hands the first time, just as a show of good faith. So the next time, the next project, it's not an issue.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, how does your company communicate with the landowners in terms of providing them a contact that they can easily reach to follow up if they have any challenges or problems with the reclamation?
We, as part of our project team, we have a land agent who's the lead on the project for land and landowner issues, and he reaches out to the contractor even before we begin the survey permissions. Can we get on the land to survey? So he's the main contact that we throw out there to the landowners, and they have access to our land agent. So generally, whenever we get any landowner complaints, it's come from our land agent, and it's fed back to One Oak, and we fix it immediately.
And what kind of authority do those land agents have?
Authority as
like say the, you know, to address the concerns and the problems that the landowners are having.
If it's one based on caused by our construction efforts, they feed it back and we go fix it. But they generally bring it back to One Oak. Mm-hmm. As far as financial authority, there's some leeway there, but it comes directly from One Oak. Even at my level, at the project management, there are still some authorities that I don't have. So, but generally, whenever we get any complaints out there, the landowner lets them know that, the land agent lets them know that, you know, I agree, it's due to our construction and we'll fix it. And there and then we start mm-hmm. working towards fixing it.
And are those land agents One Oak employees or are they contract employees?
We have a mix of contract and One Oak employees. On this particular project, they're contract employees. Okay. But they report to a One Oak land agent.
Do they, is it the same person who follows the project from beginning to end?
Yes, typically, yes.
And are they on board? So if it's a contract land agent, you know, a year and a half down the road, will they still be able to connect, or will that be a good contact for the landowner?
In the case where they're not able to connect, we also leave them with the One Oak staff that they can reach out to And again, landowners that we've dealt with in this area know how to reach out to either the area reps maintaining the pipeline, or if they contact the One Oak land agent on contract that is no longer on the project, it feeds it back to One Oak saying, hey, I dealt with this landowner a year ago and they think there's a problem here. So we would get the message back sent to One Oak.
And how do you communicate these contact people with the landowners? How do they learn about them and know who they are long-term to connect with?
Well, they pull documents on preliminary routes to know who the landowner they need to talk to is, and they reach out either by phone or go have one-on-one meetings with the landowners.
So, but when the project is, you know, near the end or construction is complete, how does the company communicate with the landowner saying, if you have any problems moving forward, here's who you call?
We typically have it in our, the easement documents they sign would have a contact for the landowner.
And that's both the contract person and
the One Oak.
And the One Oak.
I believe so.
Okay. I'm asking all these questions because this is probably the biggest problem that we hear about over and over and over again. And it's something that the industry and the regulators and landowners need to work together to make sure we have a good plan for these kinds of issues, realizing how much pipeline infrastructure needs to be constructed, and that landowners hold the key to that. So I've had some people email me since we noticed this hearing saying they were dissatisfied with One Oak, and I think typically some of the problems are it's frustrating to get to the bottom of something and actually get action. So I think this is an area that your company and all pipeline companies really need to work harder to address in a really thorough and proactive way with the landowners. I think, James, that's the conclusion of my questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, James, for your time today. I just have just one line of questions, not so much in this project. I think you answered the questions that I had earlier. There's already been questions that have answered them. But do you consider this an intrastate line or interstate line? I know you said transmission, but how is it?
This would be intrastate line.
Intra?
Yes.
Okay.
Meaning it's staying.
Yep. That's the same way I see it too. But when does your company report the pipeline to PHMSA?
We made a PHMSA notification on this pipeline about a month and a half ago, I believe. I think it's about a little bit over 2 months ago. PHMSA requires that we report to them maybe 90 days before construction or 60 days before construction. I'm not 100% on that, but we did make a PHMSA notification.
And the reason I'm asking is not so much for your particular project, but one of the challenges we're dealing with is what PHMSA shows in the ground to what we know is out there, there's a big disconnect. And then we're trying to build our staffing model in the PSC about what's coming, but yet what gets reported is what's in the ground. And so there's a big disconnect with us to have enough people to do the stuff we're supposed to do. So I was just curious on that. So the 60 to 90 day time frame is when you tell them. Do you know when they publish that? Probably their next report is what I'm hearing.
I'm not aware of how exactly they publish a report. I know PHMSA PHMSA is triggered when you go past 10 miles, if not 5 miles of a pipeline.
Okay. Thank you. And then I guess the last question I would ask is I know they both fall under Part 192, but as far as jurisdiction reporting, is there any major differences between just a straight gas line and an NGL line? I mean, in what you do for inspection and maintenance and operations?
There are some slight differences, but for the most part, gas transmission and natural gas liquid transmission pipelines are pretty similar in the way they're being managed by PHMSA.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Chrisman?
Most of my questions have already been asked, except for just a couple. You talked about easements, but then waivers from people who live close by but don't own the property. You said that's for someone, those questions would be for someone else later?
Yes.
Okay. And then the steel pipe, How does it arrive? Like in 20-foot sections, or how?
Yeah, for this pipeline, you can get a 20, 60, and 80. 40, 60, and 80. For this, where we're doing the 40-foot joints, and for this size of a project, we're getting it directly to the right-of-way from the vendor. So they'll be on string trucks to the right-of-way to be strung out on the right-of-way.
And those are welded together, and then are the welds x-rayed?
Yes, all the welds on this project will be x-rayed. That's pretty much standard in the industry to x-ray most of your welds.
Do they all get x-rayed, or is it a random
selection? On the one oxide, we do the 100% x-ray.
Okay. I don't have any other questions that haven't been asked.
Okay. Mr. Morrison, any follow-up?
No follow-up.
Anything else, Mr. Schmidt?
Just a couple. We just talked about transporting the pipes to the location. Are you going to have to build any roads for this project?
No. We're going to access off of county roads and some private roads, which we have permits for.
On the amended application, back to Appendix B, where we were looking at earlier, just in the legend of that map, it says there's a difference in color. Part of the pipeline shows that it's black and white. Part of it's red and black, and the red and black's portion of it says that it's co-located. Can you just describe what this pipeline will be co-located with?
I think this would mean there are other pipelines around in that area. I think another witness can also take a stab at this when we get into the environmental part.
Okay. Earlier you testified that the NGL, basically it's just the liquid that comes out of the gas, so it's heavier than the gas that comes in. So if this NGL, this liquid, ends up in a spill, what kind of effects are we going to see?
And again, I think that would be answered by another witness. But again, once they hit atmospheric pressure, they generally flash off. It takes a longer time to have them lift off because they're heavier than gas and heavier than air.
I have no further questions.
Commissioners, anything further? Okay. Thank you. You can step down. Mr. Morrison, you can call your next witness.
And the next witness will be Jeff Newman.
Mr. Newman, again, I'm required to advise you that the penalty for perjury in North Dakota is a Class C felony, punishable by maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Jeff, will you state your name and spell your last name for the record, please?
Jeff Newman. Last name's N-E-W-M-A-N.
Can you tell us by whom you're employed and what capacity?
One Oak Partners, as the operations supervisor of the Bakken system.
And in that capacity, are you familiar with the system that One Oak has implemented for emergency response and coordination of emergency response matters with local communities?
Yes.
Can you describe for the commission what One Oak does in the North Dakota area and with respect to this pipeline on emergency response?
Yes. We're members of the North Dakota Pipeline Association. One thing that we do is we stay in close contact with landowners. We mail brochures, safety brochures, to all of our landowners, emergency responders. We are in close contact with emergency responders, both county and local officials. We hold annual meetings for emergency responders. We share our emergency response plan with them. We also do emergency response drills.
And will this particular pipeline be included in the upcoming emergency response plan?
Yes, it will.
And that will be provided to the McKenzie County personnel, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Does One Oak have personnel available to respond to any incidents on a 24/7 basis?
Yes, we do.
And do you know which office they would be responding out of?
Sydney.
And I don't think I have any further questions of this witness this time.
In the event of a leak, how long will it take for One Oak to respond?
Anywhere from on-site, be 30 minutes to an hour.
Can you just kind of briefly describe the system you have in place to monitor the pipeline in case of a leak and how that would trigger the response, emergency response plan?
Yeah, I think James kind of touched a little bit about SCADA. Mm-hmm. But we have 24-hour monitoring from our personnel in Tulsa, our control center. Any drop in pressure or anything like that, they alert our people on the ground who are also dispatched to the site too as well. And that response time, anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour, is obviously going to be, you know, dependent upon their location at the time that they receive the information.
How many different pipelines does that control center monitor at one time?
Well, we actually monitor all of our systems, but we have different consoles. That specific console actually monitors what's called the Bakken system, which is the one main line from Montana down into Colorado. And then it'll be this one here and then two others in Wyoming.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Shook, anything at this time?
No.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Sure. Just a couple of questions, Jeff. So you've got the 24-hour monitoring that would detect drops in pressure and changes in volumes, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Would those be the two biggest detection mechanisms for identifying a leak?
It would. We also have aerial patrol. We have flyovers over our pipeline system, too, as well. Our area rep is also in the area doing what we call line locates, one calls.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody who may call a local one call center and need the line located.
And what's the frequency of your aerial patrols?
Every 14 days.
Have you ever looked at, this is kind of an aside, but have you looked at unmanned aircraft at all for aerial patrols?
We haven't as of yet. We've heard about them, but
okay.
Not yet.
It's another industry North Dakota is going to be a leader in. So we're excited about that. And its applications, potential applications out here for companies like yours. If you were to have a leak, describe for me the greatest, both public safety and environmental damages that would occur. What are the greatest safety and environmental risks of a leak?
You know, when our product is released to the atmosphere, it's obviously heavier than air, kind of collects in low areas and stuff like that. It is a flammable product. As far as the environment, you know, if it actually gets into the ground, we actually clean up that area. We bring in a special contractor that actually cleans up, the contaminated area. As far as the actual environmental impact and stuff like that, that's probably better for somebody, a different witness.
Okay. If it's leaking in the ground, does it evaporate from 4 feet below, or what happens to it?
Well, it all depends on what the location is. Sometimes it may bubble up. There may be a pool of liquid on the surface. There may be some vapors, maybe a frost ball or something. Towards the top of the ground. Could be some dead vegetation. And those are things that our people are looking at from the air and on the ground both as well.
Mm-hmm. Has your company ever had any significant NGL pipeline leaks?
No, ma'am.
Okay. All right, Jeff, I think that's all my questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Kalk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Jeff. It's interesting. I spent a couple days with your plan over in Sydney and went through all this stuff for a different hearing. So that's information I know, but it's not in this record, right? So anyway, so bear with me. But I know your system pretty well up there. But one of the things that I always try to understand is that relationship between, you know, like the worst case scenario, like for the gas plants, when we cited for One Oak, we had a blast radius that, that you're able to figure out, and you locate that with all the emergency managers. But in something like these NGLs, the way I understand it, there's not this risk like there would be from just a straight gas. It's, this pipe is not going to blow up. It's just going to, I mean, is that the same way you understand it?
Yes, we don't affiliate blast with our pipeline.
Absolutely. It's like a crude pipeline, the same kind of thing. It's a heavy liquid that you can have some environmental stuff in there. But when you file your emergency response plan with McKenzie County, it's already, I'm guessing, approved by PHMSA, correct?
That's correct.
So when do you file that with PHMSA, what your plan is for this pipeline? Back to the same kind of questions I asked James.
Well, it's going to be a, it's not an actual site-specific plan, but it's actually more of a, it's the plan that we have in our O&M operations and maintenance plan manual.
So the same kind of protocol you used in your previous NGL line, this will just get rolled into
That's correct, yes.
But that plan had to be...
That's been approved by PHMSA, right. That's correct.
Okay. And so as far as this pipeline, you're not going to anticipate anything in this one that you're not already prepared for in your other pipelines?
That's correct.
Okay. And then the one thing, though, the SCADA system, is the SCADA system, how does it check drops in pressure? You know, what kind of pressure is this pipeline under as far as the... feet per, I forget it, pounds per PSI, pounds per square inch. Is it under the amount of pressure where you can check, get pressure drops right away, or has it got a leak for a while before
it's immediate.
Okay. So your answer that the response is 30 minutes, you're going to have some type of immediate response. So you're not going to, if an operator sees something, they're not going to wait 30 minutes to shut something down.
They're not. No, I was talking to actual people on the ground, our actual local, what we call our local area rep, his response time from Sydney.
Okay. So if Operator X sees something while they're doing it, what's the first thing they would do if they notice a big drop in pressure?
They'd contact the local area rep. They'd contact me as well, and we'd shut the pipeline system down.
Okay, so they have to contact you to shut the pipeline down. They can't do it themselves right away?
They can do it themselves, but they have to get a hold of somebody first to find out specifically what's going on rather than just shut the pipeline down right away. It depends on what the drop in pressure. If it's just a small drop in pressure, it could be, there are different variables why we may have small drop in pressure, but a big drop in pressure or something like that, they're actually going to shut the system down.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Jeff. That's it.
Commissioner Chrisman?
I think the only other question that I would have is, are you the one who would discuss easements?
No.
From neighboring landowners?
No, okay.
And no other questions.
Anything further, Mr. Morrison?
Nothing further.
Okay. Mr. Schmidt?
Nothing further.
Commissioners? Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Just to make sure I'm understanding this, and it's a chemistry question. When this product leaks, my understanding is it evaporates. It's not just a liquid that lays around on the ground like crude oil is. So describe it to me.
When it actually hits the air, the atmosphere, it forms a vapor cloud, like a white cloud, but it does kind of dissipate, but it actually forms a white cloud, kind of hovers around the ground, but it's not liquid when it comes out. It's not in a liquid state.
So it doesn't really pool on the ground or flow. It's got to be under pressure to be
liquid.
That's
correct.
So it just sort of hovers around. It's the kind of in between a gas and liquid.
Yes.
And so how flammable is that?
Well,
if it's hovering.
It is a flammable product, and one thing that we do is we talk to the landowners. Besides mailing a pipeline safety brochure, we actually talk to each of our landowners, and make sure that they understand the impacts and what to do in the event of an emergency and things like that. And, mm-hmm. and we also, you know, we discuss and we stress to them that it is a flammable product.
So, is it highly explosive, flammable, or is it pretty benign when it's hovering?
It's a highly flammable product.
How long does it take to dissipate? Like if you were
that kind of depends upon the weather conditions.
Mm. So give me some scenarios.
If it's cooler outside and things like that, it's kind of hover more around. It'd probably take a little longer to actually dissipate than if it was warm.
So when there's a leak, how do you clean it up? What do you do with this?
Well,
for it to go away?
It will eventually dissipate. Yes, and anything that actually might have gotten into the soil, might have contaminated the soil, we actually do studies on that and bring an actual special contractor in that actually cleans all that up.
Mm-hmm. Is it something that's a matter of hours, days, months to have it float away?
No, it's hours.
Hours. Okay. And in that scenario, are people advised to stay away from it? I mean, you wouldn't want to be driving through it or...
No, yes, people are advised to stay away from it. And depending upon the location, we may stop traffic and ask for emergency responders to help us stop traffic on the roadways. And it depends on if it's headed towards some dwellings, we may help evacuate or shelter in place.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that description.
Mr. Morrison? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Newman. You can step down. We're going to take about a 10-minute break before we start with the final witness. So.